Welcome to the Animal Law Podcast. This is Marianne Sullivan. My guest this week is Christina Stella of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. She'll be discussing a fascinating case, which is rooted in a provision of the California State Constitution governing water use, which is, of course, a very big deal in California. And I have to say that even I was shocked to find out the amount of water it takes to slaughter chickens. I wasn't shocked about the hideous cruelty involved. And, you know, in these times of dire, extreme drought, it really is pretty shocking to find out how poor communities in California's Central Valley are suffering as a result of the amount of water used to kill these poor birds. So before we get to that interview, I hope you will also check out the Our Hen House podcast, which I co-host along with Jasmine Sanger. I mean, I don't want you to check it out before you listen to this interview, but I do want you to check it out after that. And some recent episodes that might be of interest include episode 601 with Aisha Akhtar, who's heading up the Center for Contemporary Sciences. And she had some really very hopeful things to say about the battle to get animals out of laboratories and how modern science is actually helping that effort. Episode 599 has an amazing interview with Seb Alex. Wow, you really have to listen to this. He's a Lebanese activist, passionate. And he talks about lots of things, but particularly about the vegan and animal rights scene in Beirut and beyond. And then episode 602 with Thomas Goodwin is about the organization he founded, Plant Dining Partnerships, which is working at a grassroots level to get more vegan options in restaurants. And I am all for that. And I'd also like to take a moment to ask for your support for the Animal Law Podcast and the Our Hen House Podcast. If you are right now in a place where you can help out, please go to ourhenhouse.org/donate. There you can join our flock for $10 a month or $100 a year. You can also make a one-time donation in any amount that is comfortable for you, and we would be so grateful for that. Okay, let's get to this interview because it's really interesting. As a managing attorney at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Christina Stella litigates on behalf of farmed, wild, and captive animals who are subjected to systemic cruelty and exploitation in commercial industries. Her cases primarily focus on increasing transparency in the industrial agriculture system and challenging industrial agricultural practices that harm animals, the environment, and public health. Christina also teaches animal law as an adjunct professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, and she's the co-author of the investigative report America's Secret Animal Drug Problem: How Lack of Transparency is Endangering Human Health and Animal Welfare. And she will be joining me right after this.
I want to tell you about an amazing service for anybody who's practicing animal law or interested in animal law. The Brooks Animal Law Digest is a premier free online publication dedicated to offering in-depth and up-to-date coverage on today's most important animal law and policy issues. Published weekly as a collaborative effort with Harvard Law School's Animal Law and Policy Program, the Digest is a Brooks Institute service to the animal protection community. It can be like having a full-time lawyer on your staff researching and reporting to you on U.S. current legal developments related to animal protection issues. This digest is a resource for anyone interested in learning more about the field of animal law, either as a high-level overview of weekly developments for those who are focused on specific work, but nevertheless want to stay aware of other actions, or as a jumping-off point for digging into a specific current issue in the field. Features include allowing you to compile updates by category, search by key terms, and each issue contains links to background materials that will orient the reader around that specific issue. There are weekly highlights as well as quarterly summaries. You can subscribe to the Brooks Animal Law Digest at thebrooksinstitute.org.
Welcome to the Animal Law Podcast, Christina.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you. We've been trying to put together this interview on this case, which is really interesting. It's really a different twist. And we've been trying to put it together for a while. So I'm very pleased that we're finally talking about it. And, you know, only in animal law would you be happy to be talking about chicken slaughter, but That's what we're talking about. And just tell us about the Foster Farms Chicken Slaughterhouse. This is in Livingston, California. Give us an idea of how big it is and how many chickens it slaughters. And since the case revolves around water, how much water does it use?
Yeah, so the Foster Farm Slaughterhouse, like you said, is located in Livingston, California. So for folks who aren't familiar with California, that's in the Central Valley or the San Joaquin Valley, which is the central part of our state. It's an area that's increasingly prone to drought. It's actually in the middle of a mega drought and suffers from persistent drought, you know, which will continue to occur as, you know, we're continually affected by climate change. It's in an area that's a very heavily factory farm. There's a huge volume of factory farms in that area. And the slaughterhouse in particular that's located in Livingston uses 65% of Livingston's water supply. So it uses 3 to 4 million gallons of drinkable water every day. Just to put that in context, there are 5 different Nestle bottled water facilities all around the state, and combined, all 5 of those facilities use just under 2 million gallons a day. So that's for 5 different plants throughout the state. So Foster Farms is using, you know, double that amount just for one plant in one city. Livingston, like I said, is located in this area of the state that is, you know, suffering from drought and heat waves. The wells in the city are contaminated with arsenic, lots of other chemicals, and water is a really scarce resource in this area. So the amount that Foster Farms is using is really egregious kind of in the context of this geographic area.
So what are they mainly using the water for, and why does it require this unbelievable amount of water?
Yeah, so one of the things that they're using the water for is what's known as live hang slaughter, and it specifically uses something called electric immobilization. So just to kind of explain the process, when animals, when chickens and other birds are brought to this slaughterhouse, you know, they're taken off the trucks, they're shackled to move through the slaughter line. And as part of that, they are taken through an electrified water bath. That is meant to basically render them immobile. It's supposed to render them unconscious, but we're not sure that it actually does that. But it does render them immobile so that they're kind of stunned and can move through the rest of the slaughter line, you know, of course, including the step where their throats are slit, in a uniform manner. And then after that, they're processed through a defeathering bath, and then they are further processed to kind of clean the carcasses after they've been slaughtered. So that's leaving out some parts of the slaughter process, but kind of highlighting the points at which water is used. So animals who are brought through this live hang slaughter system are handled while they're alive. Obviously, they're terrified. You know, they could be being handled roughly. And so they basically kind of make a mess. You know, they could be thrashing. They often defecate and vomit on themselves. And I say all that to explain that then it requires more water at the end of the slaughter process to clean their bodies because they're in such bad shape from having been handled in that way and just subjected to the stress of the slaughter line.
Yeah, it's a horrible story to start off this case with, but that's really what it's all about.
Yeah.
So where do they get the water? Where does water come from in the Central Valley in California?
Yeah, so Foster Farms buys water from the city of Livingston, and the city of Livingston pulls the water from the Merced subbasin. So this is a critically overdrafted subbasin, which basically means that it's recognized by the California water regulators to be overdrafted in the sense that if its water extraction continues at the rate that it's extracted today, it will have long-term social, economic, or environmental consequences for the area. So it's not a sustainable water source, but that's where Foster Farms water is coming from. It's pulling groundwater from the subbasin.
And you had mentioned briefly climate change, and you talked about it in the complaint as well, with some predictions about how much worse this situation will get. I'm kind of wondering, has the situation worsened even since, I'm not sure when you filed this complaint, but it seems like things are just so awful everywhere. I'm just wondering whether things are already getting worse.
Yes, we filed the lawsuit in 2020, in the fall of 2020. And as anyone who lives in California knows, we're facing another summer of, you know, persistent drought, heat waves, of course, wildfires. The situation in California is definitely becoming more dire, it seems, with every passing year. And the Central Valley is in a mega drought and is expected to continue in a drought, if not worsen, over the long term. I don't know the exact numbers of the water that's available last year to this year, but it's definitely recognized as a persistent problem that's expected to get worse every year.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe it's going to get better, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So given this pretty dire situation, I mean, I assume this is a poor area and the people who live there are not well off. And I'm just wondering, why is it that Livingston is selling so much of its water? Is it because they absolutely need the money? Is it properly priced? Is there any corruption involved? Or are you really not privy to those kinds of details?
We're not privy to those details. They certainly go kind of beyond what we've alleged in the complaint. But I can say, you know, the Central Valley, like I said, is very heavily saturated with factory farms and slaughterhouses. And so I think it's an area of the state that the industry just takes advantage of. And Foster Farms actually has a history of depleting and degrading Livingston's water, too. So previously, before Foster Farms built its own treatment plant, it actually was using the Livingston treatment plant, which was located right along the Merced River. And that, you know, municipal treatment plant was exclusively devoted to treating the slaughterhouse's wastewater. And then actually in 2006, the California Regional Water Quality Board issued a cease and desist order to the plant because it had such persistent violations and documented pollution to the groundwater and then also some other issues too. But then Livingston and Foster Farms actually litigated against each other, basically to figure out who should be responsible for the cost of the required upgrades and remediation. And so as a result of that, Foster Farms agreed to construct its own treatment plant and to stop using Livingston's. So, and now Foster Farms regularly violates its water discharge permit. So a little bit different from, you know, why is Livingston allowing Foster Farms to use so much water? But I think it just speaks to kind of the history there, where Foster Farms is, you know, has been a longtime player in this community and has a really long track record of kind of just taking advantage of the community and the resources that it's been supplied.
Yeah, it sounds like a dire situation. Speaking of treatment, so Foster Farms is treating the water, which, I mean, it has to be treated. So this is the wastewater, because they do all these horrible things to these chickens, mm-hmm. and the water is filthy. And then so then they collect that wastewater and they treat it. And is that right? And what happens to that water? And do they just return the amount of water that they took? Or is that water, like, does it become drinkable? Like, what happens after the treatment?
Yes, these are all great questions. So Foster Farms does not return the same amount of water that it takes. So of the water that it takes, so first of all, the water that it gets from the city of Livingston is drinkable quality, and it still puts it to this purpose of slaughtering chickens. So it's using drinkable water, and then it, like you said, it becomes wastewater, and then it is treated, I can't quite remember all of the details. I think it's like to remove suspended solids first, and then it's applied to kind of the wastewater discharge fields that Foster Farms has. I think it's like just under 230 acres of a wastewater discharge field. And that means that it literally just applies the wastewater to that field and then kind of lets nature do its thing. So 30 to 40% of the water that Foster Farms takes out of the aquifer or the subbasin is permanently lost. And then it returns 60 to 70% to the subbasin through these wastewater discharge fields. So that water is lost in a variety of ways, one of which is just from being applied to fields, you know, it evaporates or it runs off to other places. It doesn't actually end up, you know, recharging the subbasin. And the water that it does return is not of drinkable quality. It's still wastewater. So it's taking out a higher quality of water than it's putting back, and also a higher quantity than it's putting back.
So what would be the city's, is the city allowed to just refuse to sell them water? I mean, I know they need the money, but aside mm-hmm. from that, like, are there requirements that the city should sell businesses water?
That's a good question. I mean, we named the city as a real party in interest to our lawsuit to basically, you know, allow the city to protect its interests if it did want to say we want the ability to sell Foster Farms water, or we're actually grateful to have the opportunity not to have to sell them water. And they declined to get involved. So they just said basically they submit to the court's jurisdiction, whatever the court orders, they will abide by. but they're not otherwise getting involved. So we don't have a great sense of kind of Livingston's position in all this. I mean, I think there is that history there between them where they know that Foster Farms has abused water resources in the past, but I can't really speak to, you know, why Livingston might continue to do it or might do it despite the degradation that it causes. I'm sure economic concerns are paramount, but beyond that, I'm not sure. And they haven't told us.
All right. So I think that kind of sets the scene. Let's get to the lawsuit, which is interestingly based on the state constitution. It's also, you never know what you're going to learn in animal law. Now we're learning all about water treatment, and now we're going to look at the California state constitution. So before we get into the details of this suit, can you just tell us what the relevant provision of the California constitution is that you're suing under?
Yes. So it's Article 10, Section 2 of the California constitution. This provision basically codified the common law reasonable use doctrine. And so essentially it mandates that any waters of the state be put to both reasonable and beneficial use. And that applies equally to surface water and to groundwater that Foster Farms is using. The provision also requires that water be put to a reasonable method of use. So it takes into account, you know, the ways that water is being used. And it basically says that, you know, individual water users don't have, you know, a right to use water unreasonably or non-beneficially. It applies to all users, not just water rights holders. So it's an incredibly powerful constitutional provision.
Yeah, so it's not just up to the city here what happens to this water. There are limitations. And, you know, I have a side question, but I want to ask it now before we get into this, because I'm always interested in this. I know that there are lawyers working on this who seem to be water lawyers. I'm just always curious. I mean, and you're the plaintiffs here, I think. Can you explain how that works, how you work with other lawyers and you know, how you divide up the work?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the Animal Legal Defense Fund is a plaintiff and we're also co-counsel in the suit.
Right.
So yeah, when we get involved in suits like this that require a certain expertise or specialty, we do often partner with other lawyers, either pro bono lawyers or other public interest lawyers, or in some cases, private firms to represent us, you know, to provide that expertise that we really need to be successful in the case. So California water law is incredibly complicated.
And I can imagine. I'm already a little confused.
It is. And California is a very unique state in terms of its water rights system. And so, yeah, we just look for, you know, folks we can partner with who we think have the relevant experience and expertise to really make the best decisions for the case. And we work very closely with them. You know, it's an absolute equal partnership. We work in tandem. We share the work and just try to always make sure, you know, that we're making the best decisions in the case that are informed by, you know, practitioners who practice in this state and in this area of law, maybe on a more regular basis than we do.
Yeah, that's cool. It must be nice to get a chance to work with different people on different issues. I would like that. So back to the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So you brought this action against Foster Farms, and it has two causes of action, I think, and we'll get to them in a minute. But they then filed a demurrer. And I don't even know whether it's right to say they filed a demurrer because, you know, the rest of the country, Christina, we don't use that term.
Right.
I did look it up, and I found out they also use it in Virginia. But here in New York, not so much. So before we go any further, I just want to clarify California terminology. Basically, it's just a pre-answer motion to dismiss, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right. And so there's no summary judgment here. There's no questions of the evidence or the facts or anything. The first issue, of course, as always, is in every animal law case, no matter what the topic is standing. And they actually argue that only the city of Livingston has standing to sue, which I don't see why the city of Livingston would ever sue them, but since they're in contract with, I don't know. Like it doesn't make sense to me. The city of Livingston's kind of agreed to this. But anyway, you contend that you clearly have standing. Can you tell us why?
Yes. And I should clarify too that the defendants argue that we don't have standing basically because we, as the Animal Legal Defense Fund, are not water rights holders. So they argue that this provision only applies or can only be enforced between two different water rights holders. So we argue that we do have standing for two reasons. One is that California has something that we call the private attorney general doctrine that basically allows private parties who are acting in the public interest to bring suits like this if they will benefit the public interest and are kind of brought, you know, just like it sounds, to benefit the public, which this suit does. And so we argued that. And we also argued that the Animal Legal Defense Fund has representational standing based on the impacts of Foster Farms water use to our individual members who live in the Central Valley and whose wells are going dry. They are subjected to water rationing and their, you know, their water sources are otherwise being affected by virtue of Foster Farms consuming so much of the available water.
And are there other cases that give public interest organizations a right to sue to enforce this particular water rights article of the Constitution? Or is this a case of first impression?
It's well settled that this can be used between private parties. So in our view, there's no question that this is a proper, you know, application of that doctrine. And luckily, the court agreed.
Okay. Yeah. And we'll get to the court's decision, which was so short that, you know, but I think we can sum up with it at the end, because there, I'd like to get to the main argument, and that's that you have failed to state a cause of action. And so let's go through your two causes of action, both of which are based on the language of, in the Constitution that we just went over. And the first cause of action has to do with reasonable use. And what are the factors the court looks at in determining whether the use they are making of this water is reasonable?
So the court treats this kind of as a totality of the circumstances test, looking at several different factors, like you said. So the key ones that we highlight in our papers are, one, the need for conservation. And this need to conserve water is actually treated as paramount or transcendent to all of the other factors. So this is like the overarching, most important factor that the court looks at. Then there's the state of existing water resources in the area, which, as we were talking about earlier, you know, the Central Valley, because of its water scarcity, persistent drought, mega drought, et cetera, the state of existing water resources in the area are really so scarce that this was a very strong factor in our favor. There's also local custom. So the court can look to how water is used in the locality to determine if a particular use is reasonable. And in this instance, Foster Farms is using far more water than any of its similarly situated users. So it uses, I think, 3 times more water than other cities of comparable size. So again, its use kind of exceeds local custom. Secondary impacts, including to water quality. So again, as we talked about before, you know, we argue that Foster Farms' water use and water extraction not only depletes the quantity of water that's available, but it also degrades water quality. So that goes to this factor. And then the availability of less water-intensive alternatives. So we argue that there are less water-intensive alternatives to live hang slaughter that are better for animals while using less water. And I'm sure, you know, we'll get to that. We can talk about it in a moment, but those are basically the factors that we focused on. And I should highlight too that this kind of what is a reasonable use and then how reasonable use relates to beneficial use is not really like a static determination. They're very context dependent and they're kind of relative to each other. So what's a beneficial use might not necessarily be a reasonable use in context. And it really depends on, you know, what is actually, according to these 5 factors that we've just gone over, you know, what is the context of the use? So it's like a very dynamic analysis.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like one of the really important factors is that you have an alternative that you propose. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So we highlight controlled atmosphere killing or controlled atmosphere stunning as an alternative process to live hang slaughter that uses less water. So in these slaughter processes, animals are brought in on trucks and they are euthanized, for lack of a better word. I wouldn't really use that term anywhere in the animal ag industry, but they're killed while they're still on the trucks using gases. And so they're never actually handled live. So that very much reduces the stress that they suffer. You know, they're not actually removed from their crates, handled, shackled, improperly stunned, etc., all those things we were describing before. So it's considered to be a more humane slaughter method than live hang slaughter. And because it uses gas, it doesn't require the stun bath, it uses less water. And it also uses less water at the end of the process because the animals are not handled live, they're not subjected to the same stress, and their bodies are in better condition. So it requires less water on the back end to clean the animal carcasses to prepare them for sale.
So I remember reading about people in the movement have been talking about controlled atmosphere stunning for a long time. And I just wanted to make clear, like when you talk about gas, my understanding is that the gases that they use, it's not like using carbon dioxide or something. They're supposed to not give the birds the sensation that they're suffocating. I don't know whether that's true, but that's what I've heard about it. So it is supposed to be a much less inhumane method of slaughter. But, you know, it does bring up the question, like a lot of cases, almost all cases involving the inhumane treatment of farmed animals, the relief sought ultimately makes production more expensive. And mm-hmm. you are saying here that controlled atmosphere slaughter is actually not more expensive, which seems to be would be a great argument for you with the court. And but, you know, with like I'd like to make I like to make animal production more expensive. So there's kind of a little bit of an issue there that I just wonder, well, in the first place, let's just talk about whether and why you believe that controlled atmosphere stunning will not be more expensive. In fact, you're arguing that it would be less expensive.
Right. So we're arguing that there are costs up front to upgrade or transition the slaughterhouse to this new kind of infrastructure, but that in the end, it won't, you know, foster farms can recoup that money over time and it won't necessarily have to operate at a loss. And part of how we show that is because foster farms has converted to this system or has reportedly converted to this system at other slaughterhouses. And there is kind of a trend in the industry to move towards this slaughter system. So this is all to show the court that it is a feasible alternative, because if you can't show that there's a feasible alternative, you know, it's more difficult to make the case to the court. So we need to be able to say, you know, it's not going to cost $500 million and really be cost prohibitive. I just use that number as an example. I don't actually know the numbers, but all to say it's not cost prohibitive to do this, and it won't, you know, completely shut down the entire business and cause them to go bankrupt. That's a very important showing for the court we needed to make. And so, yeah, we think that we've presented enough evidence to show that it is a feasible, you know, affordable alternative. And yeah, absolutely. It's a difficult thing to argue that you should be, you know, slaughtering animals in one way versus another, or, you know, it's certainly not our intention to create any cost savings for the animal agriculture industry over time. But in this particular case, their water use is so egregious, and it really is so closely tied to this method of slaughter that, you know, it seems worthwhile to try to stop it with this case.
Yeah, I'm just curious, like, is this something that is part of the discussion when you're taking on a case, whether ultimately this might make it easier for the industry to slaughter animals, but there are such immediate benefits, both, you know, both for the water use, but also welfare benefits. I mean, we are both against killing animals, but we're also, you know, hoping that they suffer a little less. You know, they're in a somewhat higher circle of health. So do these discussions go on when you're deciding whether to take a case?
Absolutely. Yes. I think all animal advocates deal with these problems in all of their cases. That could probably be a whole other, you know, hour-long podcast episode of just the strategic and, you know, ethical and all the other considerations that go into deciding, you know, whether or not to file a particular case. But the whole world of animal law is an exercise in incremental progress, right? So we do hope that by solidifying this law in California, that it has, you know, precedential value beyond just this case, so that it can be, you know, used for other animals in perhaps even more impactful ways.
And I mean, foster farms just not want to do this, apparently. I don't know why they just don't do it if it is cheaper. So there must be some disadvantage to them in doing, I guess, as you mentioned, there's upfront costs and they just don't want to do it until they have to or something, but hopefully they will have to. You also argue that the use is unreasonable per se. Can you just explain what that means?
Yes. So in some contexts, water use can be unreasonable per se. So it's kind of not looking as much at the context, but just saying that the use in and of itself in any context is unreasonable. One of the strongest cases on that point with a finding of water use being unreasonable per se is a case from 1935, actually, between two irrigation districts, where one irrigation district was using water in a water scarce area to kill gophers in order to protect agricultural crops. And the court held that that was a per se unreasonable use and basically said it's so obvious that this is not a reasonable use of water to kill animals in this way, especially in a water scarce area. And so the court said that it was self-evident that that was an unreasonable use.
So you're arguing not that chicken slaughter is not an important beneficial use, but this type of chicken slaughter is not an important beneficial use. Is that right?
Right. So it's like the method of water use that is unreasonable. So, you know, well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We could talk about beneficial use and the hierarchy of uses. And so, you know, the animal agriculture is, you know, an industrial use that falls on the spectrum of types of beneficial uses. But yes, we argue that using it in this area for the purpose of killing animals and in the way that it's done in this particular live hang system with electric immobilization is an unreasonable use.
Do they have to use the most efficient method? Or is there a gradation of how efficient they have to be?
No, there's no rule that says that they have to use the most efficient. I mean, I think ultimately what the court orders in order to kind of realize a reasonable use of water, that will be in the court's discretion. But our key showing is that, like we were just saying, that there are feasible alternatives that use less water than the practice that we're alleging is unreasonable.
I would think also with the worsening water situation, since this is a somewhat flexible standard, that the standard may become tougher. I mean, this, you know, if the court considering this year might have a different opinion than 10 years ago when the water situation was perhaps not as dire.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Because like we were saying before, too, the reasonable use analysis is the totality of the circumstances, and it really is highly context dependent and dynamic. And so I absolutely think that as water continues to become more scarce, and we'll probably see more water restrictions and other, you know, actions to protect water, that all goes into the analysis.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It'll be an interesting case to watch. You know, I'm not sure that this question goes here, and forgive me if it doesn't, but I know that you pointed out in your papers that in your view, Foster Farms is in violation of the California Humane Methods of Slaughter Act. Not that many states have the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act. You know, as we know, the federal one doesn't apply to birds at all, but California's does. And can you tell me in what ways they are in violation of this law?
Sure. So the California Humane Methods of Slaughter Act requires that birds, as relevant to this case, be rendered insensible to pain before slaughter. And our argument is that it's very unlikely that the voltage that's used in the stun baths in electric immobilization in live hang slaughter actually meets that standard of rendering them insensible to pain versus just basically paralyzed, but still fully conscious. And so we point that out as a way of, again, demonstrating that that use of water in the electric immobilization stage of the slaughter process is an unreasonable use and an unreasonable method of use, because it could potentially be in violation of this other law.
Yeah, I feel like for as long as I can remember, there's been this debate between the animal rights movement and the industry about whether chickens are rendered unconscious by that electrified bath that they run their heads through. And it would be nice to have a real answer to that question. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we get that, but you have to believe that the amount of energy that the industry puts into fighting having birds considered under the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act federally, when they claim that they're rendering them unconscious already, there's something wrong there. So I think that that's another piece of strong evidence that electrified bath, just as the movement has been saying for a long time, just paralyzes them, which is just the most horrifying thing. So you're saying the fact that they're violating that statute is another thing that impacts on whether their water use is reasonable. Are there other instances in which, not this statute in particular, but in other statutes that don't have anything to do with water use, the fact that they're being violated does impact on a water use decision?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I can speak to any more than what we've named in our papers, you know, which we've already gone over. I'm sure that that does become relevant in other cases. It hasn't in ours specifically. But yeah, it is certainly all related.
Yeah. Well, there probably aren't that many other instances in which there's a law that's completely unenforced and you have to argue it in a completely other context. So it's an unusual situation. Now, as you mentioned, it's all my fault. I've been mixing up the principles behind the two causes of action, but your second cause of action relates to maximum beneficial use. And can you just, you've kind of already alluded to it, but can you just kind of explain what that means?
Yes. And I should say you have not mixed anything up. They're very much interconnected. And so there are kind of categories of water use that are in a hierarchy of beneficial uses. So the most beneficial use of water is domestic uses. So that's basically, you know, private residents using water at their home. The next level is municipal use. And then there's agricultural, then industrial, then power generation, then recreation, aesthetic enjoyment, navigation, and then finally preservation and enhancement of water resources like fish and wildlife and other aquatic resources. So this is basically a hierarchy of uses where more beneficial uses are prioritized over less beneficial uses. And so in this case, because Foster Farms is an industrial user of water, which is, you know, fourth down the hierarchy of beneficial uses, water is being used at the Foster Farms industrial slaughterhouse that could be being used by residents of Livingston and of the water district who would be using it for their domestic use at home. So there are water restrictions for residents of this area who pull water from the sub-basin. And so basically Foster Farms is taking water away from domestic users who have higher priority and using it for an industrial purpose that has a lower priority. And so we argue that that kind of, you know, inverting of the hierarchy violates this requirement that water be put to a beneficial use.
I see. It does strike me as completely insane that there are water restrictions on people in houses when they're wasting this unbelievable amount of water. But now, is it established that this is an industrial use and not an agricultural use, or is that something you're arguing?
We argued that and then the court agreed. So in the court's order, the judge did say that this is an industrial use of water because, again, this is water for the slaughterhouse. It's not for the raising of animals or for the raising of crops to feed animals. So this particular facility is really an industrial facility as distinct from perhaps the more agricultural aspects of the factory farm industry.
Now, as to both causes of action, they also assert, I think this is in the context of failing to state a cause of action, that Foster Farms is the wrong defendant because it's just a water purchaser. If you want to complain about how the water is being distributed, you would have to sue the city who's the one who's selling it. Can you discuss how you respond to that argument?
Sure. And it's actually what we touched on earlier, this idea of the real party in interest. So when we filed the suit, right, Foster Farms was named as our defendant, but the city was named as a real party in interest. And that is basically a real party in interest is basically an entity whose interest will be directly affected by the proceeding and by the outcome of the suit. So it's kind of putting that third party on notice. You're not a named party to this suit. But it's almost similar to an intervention type standard, if people are more familiar with that from federal court, where we're saying, you know, your interests are going to be affected by this suit. So, you know, feel free to get involved if you have something to say or, you know, want to take a side. And the city declined. Like I said earlier, they just said they submit to the jurisdiction of the court. They will comply with any order that the court issues, but otherwise they don't plan to be involved. So that kind of was all that we needed to say to that point that Livingston should really be involved because we gave them the option to get involved and they didn't.
So they also argue that your motivation for bringing this action requires its dismissal because you are motivated by ending cruelty to animals and not by actually caring about water issues. Like, how did you respond to that issue, to that argument?
Yeah, I mean, we as animal advocates, I'm sure any animal advocate listening, it's a very familiar refrain from, you know, any kind of targets just to say that this is all, you know, part of an agenda. And so anything that goes beyond, you know, very specific animal rights issues is kind of, you know, just in service of these other goals. And we kind of just brushed all of that aside, that type of rhetoric that we're very used to hearing. And we just really focused on the legal standards for standing in cases like this. And again, it goes back to kind of that two-pronged approach. One, that the private attorney general doctrine absolutely provides standing to an organization like the Animal Legal Defense Fund in a case like this. We are a nonprofit public interest organization. We are bringing this case in the public's interest. And so we kind of check that box. And then beyond that, we have that representational standing as well, where our members live in this area. Their access to water is being affected. And that's very much the traditional, you know, standing showing. So regardless of the fact that, you know, we have animal in our name and that we are an animal protection organization, we're absolutely, you know, within our right to bring this suit. And again, the court agreed completely with us.
So there was also this other issue on the demurrer of the COVID executive order. This just seemed crazy to me, but I guess, you know, like you could make this argument. Can you just, so, I mean, we all, you know, are familiar with the federal administration bent over backwards to help slaughterhouses during COVID. But I don't recall it having anything to do with water. So can you just run through this?
Yes, and I agree completely. And again, so did the court, thankfully. So Foster Farms argued that the executive order that was issued during the COVID-19 pandemic, which basically just provided that slaughterhouses have to abide by federal COVID safety protocols as set by the CDC and OSHA, the White House issued this executive order, and Foster Farms argued that that essentially preempted our suit. Their argument, you know, was as unclear to us as it is to you. They did not provide any case law that shows that an executive order would have the preemptive effect that they claimed. And exactly like you pointed out, and we pointed this out as well, that the executive order only goes to COVID protocol compliance. It says nothing about any of the issues in our suit. And so, yes, that's what we argued. And luckily, again, the court agreed that that executive order did not have preemptive effect for the claims and the issues that we raise in our suit.
Yeah, it's almost like they're arguing that that executive order for that specific purpose just exempts them from any law enforcement, the enforcement of any laws until everybody's cured of COVID. This is a bizarre argument. All right, their final argument had to do with primary jurisdiction. And we haven't even dealt with the fact that there's a water board in California or what it is. But this is basically a jurisdictional argument that I didn't really understand. So I'm going to rely on you to just kind of lay it out and explain why the courts do have primary jurisdiction here.
Right. So Foster Farms argued, right, under the primary jurisdiction doctrine that our claims basically are not suited for a court to decide, that it's really the California Water Board that settles water disputes, that decides how water can be allocated, et cetera. And so they argued that this was really a matter for that agency and not for the court. And in our reply, we presented ample case law demonstrating that these types of disputes are absolutely within the jurisdiction of the court. That's very well settled in California. And so there is no primary jurisdiction problem in our court, and our claims were properly brought to a venue where they could be decided. And again, the court agreed. That's a very well settled area of law in California.
Yeah, the court held in your favor, but then said that a demurrer was not the appropriate vehicle to bring this argument. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it could come up again and you'll have to argue it again? I you know, obviously, I wasn't sure what would be the proper vehicle.
Right. That's true. Right. So the court does say that, you know, even if there were a primary jurisdiction issue, right, the demurrer is not the appropriate tool to address it. And so that does signal that it could be raised again just as a matter of law. But again, I mean, we think it's very promising that we survived at this stage. And we do feel completely confident that the case law is on our side, that the court is the place to settle water disputes like this.
Now, you've alluded to the court's decision a number of times that the court held in your favor on all of these issues, but it was such a brief decision that it's hard to go into it in detail. Is there anything else you would like to highlight from that decision that you haven't already covered?
I could probably just read the whole thing. I mean, it is about three
that might,
sentences.
That might do, yeah.
Yeah, if you'd like me to, sure. So the court, and I should say, so after we, you know, filed our papers, we, you know, opposed the demurrer, the defendants submitted a reply. And then on the day of the hearing, the court issued a tentative ruling in our favor, which was a great sign. And so very shortly after the hearing, the court adopted the tentative ruling and so just issued this very short one paragraph decision. So it says in full, although I'll leave out the case citations, but otherwise this is the full text. This court finds that Plaintiff Animal Legal Defense Fund has standing to object to an alleged unreasonable use of water, and that the possibility that the objection to unreasonable use of water is motivated by an objection to the treatment of animals or some other motive does not preclude standing to litigate the reasonableness of an industrial use of water. While COVID-19 related guidelines may be relevant to whether an injunction may issue at a given point in time, they do not preclude litigation of the underlying rights for which injunctive relief is sought and cannot preempt state law concerning unreasonable use of water within that state. Finally, this court finds that the State Water Board does not have primary jurisdiction over the unreasonable use of water claims alleging violations of Article 10, Section 2, and even if it did, a demurrer is not the appropriate tool to address primary jurisdiction.
Short and sweet.
That was the entire order, yeah.
So what are the next steps in the case?
So now we're in discovery. So we will get some information from Foster Farms that will, you know, inform the rest of the case and would also, I think, speak to some of the questions actually that you raised that we don't yet have answers to. And then from there, we will proceed through discovery either to trial or to try to resolve it, you know, through motions practice and briefs. But right now we're in the midst of discovery.
Ultimately, what relief are you seeking in the case?
So we are seeking an order that requires Foster Farms to stop its unreasonable and non-beneficial use of water. So again, it's in the court's discretion to decide how Foster Farms can effectuate that. We have presented the option of converting to controlled atmosphere stunning or killing as one way they can accomplish that. There are, you know, other aspects of production, like we talked about the, you know, kind of environmental, I think it's called evapotranspiration of wastewater that's applied to its fields, et cetera. And right, so we've pointed out, you know, all the places where Foster Farms wastewater, and then it will be in the court's discretion to decide how best to effectuate relief. But in addition to that injunctive relief, we've also asked for declaratory relief that just, you know, declares the Foster Farms use of water to the extent that it uses water and in the way it uses water is unreasonable and not beneficial so that other water users, you know, cannot use water in the same way.
And if you were to prevail in this case, would it be an important precedent for other slaughterhouses in California or, well, obviously just in California because it's California state law, but at least a kind of a precedent even in other states as a policy matter for water use for slaughterhouses?
Absolutely. This case has huge potential to have precedential value depending on how it's decided and on what the court considers. But even if it just stays within California, I mean, as we were saying, California is a huge state where the factory farm industry operates. So much of their market share comes from California that it would really have very clear real world impacts on the industry, even if limited to California. But I think absolutely it does, you know, just set the tone that industrial operations like slaughterhouses in the CAFO industry, you know, cannot operate above the law. They cannot exploit our shared natural resources for their own gain. They certainly cannot do that, you know, at the expense of animals and in order to slaughter animals in humane ways.
Yeah, it seems like it could be a huge precedent, especially since I would imagine in California, almost all the slaughterhouses are located in water-deprived areas. I mean, most of California has water problems.
Yeah, exactly. And they are concentrated in the Central Valley, which is our most water scarce area of the state. I think it also serves the purpose of just educating folks about these other ways that the CAFO industry is so environmentally irresponsible. I think a lot of us are becoming more and more aware all the time of, you know, just the ecological footprint of raising animals for food. But I'm not sure that this particular aspect of water use in the slaughter process in water scarce areas is really in the you know, public conversation as much as other parts of the industry. So we definitely hope that if nothing else, you know, folks just become more aware of the true footprint of this industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Even I was shocked by the number of gallons per day. It was insane. What was the number again?
It's 3 to 4 million gallons of water a day.
It's unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Well, it's really been interesting, Christine. I'm really excited to hear about what happens next in this case. It's an important case. Thanks for sharing with us today on the Animal Law Podcast. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Animal Law Podcast. We'll be back next month with a new show. Thanks so much to Christina for taking the time to tell us about this case. Thank you to Jen Riley and Jarab Gleckel for their help in producing the podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider doing so wherever you listen to podcasts. And please consider leaving us a good review there or on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews really make a difference. And if you're able, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at ourhenhouse.org. And thank you so much for tuning in.